It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 538 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. As always, thanks so much for listening. This week I talked with Philip Myra, a comic book writer from Chicago known for his annual anthology series Crackle. He's got a Kickstarter going on for his latest project called Purple Eyes. It's described this way: with less than an hour and a half left to live, what would you do? The best creators in indie comics bring you tales of humor, heartache, and humility. It contains 18 stories made by 33 creators. We talk about how the story came to be, about what some of the options are that you can support it on Kickstarter, and what else he's working on and coming to us in the future. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say. There's a lot to get through in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast Philip Myra, the creative force behind Purple Eyes. And it's described on, and my mouse is not helping me. There we go. Purple Eyes, Volume 1. What would you do with only 73 minutes left to live? 33 creators invite you into a world where 73 minutes before you die, your eyes turn purple. It's got 18 stories, 33 creators. So how's it going, Philip?
It's going pretty good, Wayne. How you doing?
Good, good. You're doing pretty well on the Kickstarter as we're doing. We're recording this a little early. And people always get on me because I don't do this soon enough. I'm interested in the book, and so I always want to talk about the book right away. But everybody else wants to know, when's the project going to conclude? And according to Kickstarter, the project will be funded if it reaches its goal by Wednesday, June 15, 12:02 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. So I always say, don't wait until that point. Do it before that so that poor Philip here doesn't have to keep refreshing and refreshing and refreshing and trying to see if somebody has jumped on board in the last couple of minutes or not, which a lot of people do. So anyway, so let's talk about Purple Eyes. And now you also do an anthology book once a year called Crackle.
Yeah.
And what's one of the things, I've already backed your project. One of the things I asked for was to get the Crackle copies because I was curious. Apparently, you've got already three volumes of it, right?
Yeah. So my first foray into comics has been through the Crackle anthology. So I've done the Crackles are stories that I've written, and I've had the honor to collaborate with illustrators and artists from all over the world. And there is no set theme. It's usually a bundle of stories that I write between a year to 18 months, and then I put it in a book. So there's sometimes themes that kind of just permeate just whatever's on my mind. Usually it has to deal with mortality, legacy, the choices that we make, and the cause and effect that it has for generations. Most of my stories bounce between slice of life and drama, real things that just are they're present within comics. But I think it's something that I rarely see, unless it's something from Fantagraphics or Drawn in Quarterly, where it's more about the human condition. But I mean, it's still comic, so I do those, but also put layers of fantasy on it. Like I have a story with. I have a story with two sisters traveling a fantasy world, but one of the sisters is a ghost. And I do stories of magical realism where, a lot of symbol heavy visual cues that, that are more emotional based than logic based. So this current one, Purple Eyes, this anthology, is an expansion upon one of the stories that's in Crackle Volume 3. So it's the story of the same name of Purple Eyes, and Sean Dicker, Justin Birch, and I, the three of us, we created this story about, as you mentioned, Wayne, in this world, 73 minutes before you die, your eyes turn purple, and it's 100% accurate. There's no decisions. There's no medical advice or assistance that can stop it. It's 100% accurate. It occurs for all human beings. And the type of premise is that this is like a relatively newer thing within human society. I love the TV show The Leftovers, and that's kind of like the feeling that I get when I watch that, is because like an event happened and some people think of it as the rapture, and other people look to logic and science and spiritualism. And then in between all that, there's just other ideas and other people making up their own conclusions based off limited source of information. So once the original purple eyes got completed, and you know, it was in Crackle, that was the last story within Crackle Volume 3 that was both written as script and completed, through the whole process. And it just kind of lingered. And I was like, there's something here. There's a reason why it's sticking in the forefront of my mind. It's a unique idea. But if there's any young creators out there, if you're doing short stories, the short stories need to feel like short stories. They need to have beginning, middle, and end. And they're not to be used as pitches or just like springboard jumping off points. So that the story that we did has a very finite conclusion and it's satisfying, but the world itself was kept beckoning me. And so then I decided, just to invite all my friends to have open pitch submissions, and just see what other people had, you know, giving that story prompt, like what were other people's ideas and like how would they break the rules? Or bend the rules, I should say, but not break them. And, you know, just all the other crazy ideas that you come up with just by just hearing that little story prompt.
Okay, so I'm kind of curious about a couple things. Where do the stories take place? Are they kind of all around the world? I know you're kind of from the Chicago area. Did they take place in Chicago, or how does that work?
Yeah, the original story, like I said, that Sean Dicker and Justin Birch and I created, that was set in an unnamed rural area in North America, just because it was character focused between two siblings, and we just put them in the rural area and like had the mom go far away and you don't see her, just so an excuse we can just have the two characters. But for this anthology, it's going to be international. So we have Devaki and CJ Salamander, or CG Salamander. They're both of Indian descent, and so their story is taking place in southern India, where they're from. And some of the other creators, some of the European creators, are putting their stories into their locations. One of the things that we're, that all of us 33 creators are doing together is, yes, this is an anthology, and it's going to have a variety of kind of genres and storytelling, like I said, with all the creators. But something unique what we're doing is we're meeting several times a month to come together and figure out ways to tie and link some of these stories together to give the reader like a more cohesive feel of the world. Like it's a dabble of Easter eggs, but also trying to figure out how to link some of these characters either through familial lineages, like making characters siblings of each other. But also to get to the main point is we're trying to figure out ways to place stories in similar cities. So like when you see, this is just an example, but it's not an accurate one, but like just say story three, you see this gigantic, peculiar looking building in the background. And then story eight, you see the same peculiar building in the background. And you're like, oh, these stories are happening simultaneously in this fake city, but just on the other side of town.
Okay, so that's going to be something interesting to see how you're going to tie those together.
That's going to work.
So I'm kind of curious. According to the Kickstarter page, you've got 140 plus pages of humor, heartache, and humility. That was described. And I'm going to be curious about that because, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how these all work together. And are you kind of making sure that nobody crosses this over the same material? Is that kind of one of the things that you're looking for?
Yeah. So if we can go back to the origin story. So I had open pitch submissions, and the criteria that all I asked for was, you know, you had your creative team, you know, locked in when you submitted your pitch. I wasn't going to play matchmaker, you know, pairing up artists and writers, but creative teams locked in, an estimate of how many pages you need so I can budget that, and genre, like what you think the genre is so I can get a good feel, but also what the, you know, the actual pitch. And I had 185 pitches, and I narrowed it down. I wanted to narrow it down to 12, but there was just so many brilliant ideas, and I can see kind of how things could, you know, build off of each other. So now we're at 18 stories. Yeah, which is a lot. But like looking at the genres, then I can kind of get a feel. So as far as the humor goes, there's three ones that are humor based, a combination, you know, kind of gallows humor, and some of it's just kind of like regular humor. But those three pitches were instant yeses when I read them, because I literally laughed out loud. So if just that pitch submission was funny, I know when looking at the final pages, it's going to be hilarious. And yeah, there was like, I want a good mix. So there's, like I said, the ones that Devaki and CG Salamander are doing is more of a supernatural-esque one. We have like a medical drama. We have two revenge stories, a couple ones that are just kind of like, you know, people getting their last thrills before they kick the bucket. There's a sports one. There's a really good one with a boxer. There's just a nice variety, and there's another supernatural one. So they, out of the 18 of them, there's always, you know, you flip the page and you see the creative team credits, and then you start reading the story, and you really don't know what type of story you're going to get until you're on page 2 or 3. And then that's kind of, I kind of like that surprise. And you kind of like, you're going in as cold as possible and like exploring the world.
Okay. So that's going to be kind of interesting to see. Now, on the Kickstarter page, there's actually, it looks like the story was written by you. Illustration color by Sean Dicker, lettering by Justin Birch. And there's it's winter time. And I was talking with you a little bit before we started recording about the use of purple in there. And they're not, that's something I got to ask. Is this going to be full color? Is it going to be like the section that we see on the Kickstarter page, black with only kind of occasional purple stuff? Or is it going to vary? How are you going to handle that?
Yeah. So to get to your first point, yes, it will be all in color. This individual, and I think there should be a note on there that says that these sample pages are chosen, or these sample pages use a limited color palette for emotional purposes, for emotional emphasis, but all, you know, the full book will be in full color. The sample pages that are currently on the Kickstarter are the first few pages of that original story that I said Sean Dicker and Justin Birch and I created. So that's Sean Dicker's original art. And after talking with Sean, you know, about how do we want to represent this, the initial script, this is way before even we even thought about expanding it. He thought it'd be brilliant if it'd be purple would be the only color used. It's kind of like kind of how Sin City is. We really, you know, obviously enjoy the Sin City books, mm-hmm. but just that type of feel. Like he's a very traditional artist, you know, ink on paper. So that, you know, using that color is just that much of a heightened. It's hard to see. I gotta probably update some of the files, but yeah, Justin Birch had the brilliant idea of also having, at least for this story, that the person that with purple eyes has a slight tinge of purple into their speech bubbles. I think it's a little harder to see. I'll update them, but on the physical print of Crackle Volume 3, it is very distinct. But like I said, that's what collaborating with true artists, like even letterers, they bring so many ideas and ways to enhance. It's not, you know, it's not like paid labor, it's skilled labor. Just like I said, it's things that I definitely did not have on the script, but them being true artists brought it to the final story.
I always talk about how sometimes when a writer sees the artwork, something that the artist creates sends a story off in a different direction, or something is added to the story because of what the artist does. And I always like those kinds of things. And it sounds like that's what happened here.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, even it's not shown on the sample pages, but the next page that's after the sample page that's displayed, I wrote a small montage scene, and it was, I think, six distinct things that occur. And Sean, you know, in his infinite skill, kind of expanded it and did those six things. But the way that's spread across the page is in a very the panel borders aren't like structured. So he ended up doing, I think, close to 30 panels, like a bunch of like zoom ins and, you know, a bunch of panels everywhere to emphasize, it's a montage. And within the story, 73 minutes is not a lot of time to live. So that's why he had this huge montage page. And it feels like there's more stuff going on because of all the density that he added and the ideas that he brought. And especially even I left one panel kind of just like, you know, do what you think will be natural. And they had him, he has the siblings like sword fighting for like a couple minutes, with like fake swords, and like pillows for shields and stuff. So I mean, it's like you allow your collaborators that space for them to kind of like jam and spread their own ideas. But also you as a writer, I always allow and like put in my script, like, if you think something could be done better, then go for it. Like if you need to add a panel, like add a silent panel of like a reaction or just of anything, or if you need to delete panels and straight up just delete the dialogue that I wrote, that's fine. We can, you know, the whole point is that the reader is excited and thrilled while reading it, never wanting the story to end. I mean, that's the end result. Like you want your readers to feel satisfied, and just be excited when they're reading it, instead of, you know, I know some writers kind of have that hubris and like chip on their shoulder, like, no, the script's perfect, follow the script. And like, I mean, it's just, I don't understand. I don't understand the creative process like that. Cause you can kind of, you know, a lot of us have seen and read those pages where you can kind of like tell that there was like almost like a distance between the creative teams. Like they didn't communicate that well. That's why I always try to nourish and have open discussions with all my collaborators, even in this extremely large scope of 33 of us. We're always chatting and, like I said, meeting it, you know, about once a week. It's gonna get better.
Are you Zooming or are you close enough to each other that you can actually physically meet somewhere?
No. We're Zooming. We got a fairly international cast on this. I feel bad. There's a couple. One of Alex Hutchins is in Australia and we can never get it. Like I try having it kind of early in North America to get all everyone in Asia and Europe involved. But yeah, I've never come on because it's like 3-4 a.m. every single time we meet for him. I feel bad. He's the only Australian.
Yeah. Because I used to do a podcast where one of us was in the UK, then I live on the East Coast, and then the other guy was on the West Coast. And we'd always do it on Saturday night, my time. And so I never got a Saturday night. You know, the guy in the UK, he would do it before, and then the guy in California would do it after. But I was always having to record in my Saturday night. And so I was always like, I wasn't happy with that. But that's how we did it. Because we had and sometimes as I interview people, sometimes I've interviewed people in Indonesia one time. And I had to do that about 2 a.m, so it was a good time for him. So I tried to sleep ahead of time and get ready for that. But that's the thing. I've got a question as I was reading this. Something just jumps out at me, and I've got to ask. When one of the kids that gets the purple eyes says to another kid who kind of breaks the rules, says, everybody knows the rules.
Yeah.
Is that automatic when this hits you? How do people know the rules?
So it's inferred that for this initial story, it was inferred that this is the rules of the world and like everyone knows. And reading as you go further through the story, I'm going a couple different directions, but I should say for me, one of the things that I always try to do, key part, is put as much information in page one that can be expanded upon throughout the story. Like if you're thinking like, this sounds like so much like a nerd, but if you're thinking like in a college way, you know, your first sentence is supposed to be the thesis sentence. That's why I kind of make the first page. So that specific, like every line of dialogue, like specifically like that is part of that character's journey through having purple eyes is that he's so young that it's a new aspect for him. And then one of the things that I was exploring with this character is that this is, you know, you can read the page, so this isn't spoiling anything, but the it's a young boy gets purple eyes, and so he's, you know, soon to die. But I wanted to explore how in our society, you know, teaching kids about death is almost like a reactive. It's not you're usually reacting, like saying like, you know, grandma's not going to be here anymore. You know, you're not usually explaining to your kids like that aspect of the end of life. You know, I was like, it's not like Mufasa and Simba. Like you're not having this great talk with your parents.
Right.
It's usually like at the coffin or about to go to the funeral home. So that's kind of what I was exploring, was like this kid that's, it's a newer aspect of his life. And the other, you know, his other friend kind of knows the rules. And so,
yeah, I'd be interested to see a story in which somebody doesn't know the rules and it happens and they've got 73 minutes to live, but they have to find out what's going on, and that kind of eats up valuable time. That would be an interesting story to me.
There is one that kind of plays around with that, where one, the adult has purple eyes, but the kid doesn't know what it means. And so they're carrying on a conversation like nothing's, you know, because as when it occurs to you, it's not a physical change that you can feel. Right. And you're not, you know, you're not looking at mirrors. You're not looking at yourself in the reflection of like a window or something. So the adult has no idea that this has occurred, you know, to him or her. I don't want to spoil which story this is, but because that's kind of like the dichotomy. But yeah, that's it does build upon that, because then it's like, well, this person's not going to live that much longer, mm-hmm. but they're having this conversation with this younger person. But it also adds that element to like, if the adult knew that they had not that much longer to live, would that conversation with that younger person be any different? Like, would they feel like they have to then prove and like make the last moments of their life and like bestow wisdom onto the youth, type of thing? Or is it simple enough that they're spending their, you know, they're just having a moment together, just like any other moment, you know, playing catch and stuff. So it's like things of that nature that we're kind of playing around with in the anthology. But like I said, there's like sex clubs and stuff where people with purple eyes go. So yeah, the story about the anthology bounces around a lot.
Wow. Okay. Cause see, I have to tell you right off the top that I don't deal with death very well.
Yeah.
And I've often said that to people, and it's a lot of people always, there's some people who are very good with it and very sort of, okay, yeah, that's the way it is. I have real trouble with it, and I'm old enough now where I've seen several people pass away on me, including my twin brother.
Oh, jeez.
It's my family and stuff like that. And so for me, this is going to be a real interesting travel or journey because I don't, you know, this is something that I have not really explored all that well. And I always tell people that when this kind of thing comes my way, I have to say, no, I'm not going to deal with this well. So just so you know.
Yeah.
This will be an interesting thing to see. A lot of questions come to mind when I hear about this. Did it start in one specific place and spread? These are the kind of questions that I want to know. And so are we going to get answers to those kinds of questions, or is it basically we just kind of dive in where, like you said, everybody knows?
Yeah, we kind of dive in we're kind of playing around with the time frame, but it's almost like maybe, you know, a decade and a half of before this became, you know, before like the first incidents, so now it's just kind of a thing. But I kind of want to go back. When you say like spread, do you mean like did it occur in one place in globally and then spread across the world? Or do you mean like, does it spread between like the eyes and stuff? Does it go to like other parts of the body?
Oh, I was thinking more about like, did it start in Chicago and then spread out to other parts in the United States or Canada and then spread across the world? Kind of like the pandemic kind of stuff. Yeah.
No, because that was, no, it's, I have not written the origin story. Oh man, what can I remember that? There was a South American writer, I think it was Argentine. He wrote a story called, I think, Blindness. I'm butchering. I read the book like a decade ago, but it was like the story of like this area in South America, and like everyone got blind. The story started off with, you know, it went in depth. Like the story started off with like the first person, and then it kind of spread to everyone pretty quickly up until, and then it goes through like what happens when every single person is blind and there's one character that's not blind. But it was just like interesting. So I was thinking about that, like as far as like it is a virus, but for like knowing that and reading that story, I was like, no, I like that the fact that like this is, I kept saying this in the pitches, like this, you know, this is not a disease. This is just how this world works. And, you know, there were several pitches that still confronted, the idea of purple eyes as a disease. And there were a few that were, you know, just a researcher, contracts purple eyes knowingly, and he or she, you know, commits suicide toward the end, but is like at like a huge research or like a symposium and is basically inviting everyone to inspect him or her. And there was another one that was, you know, the punchline was, you know, the person quote unquote solved the purple eyes and cured it, but died before, you know, finishing their notes. And I mean, those got rejected because, you know, it's not, you know, I try not to have it be like a logical puzzle type of stuff.
Outer limits.
Yeah.
I want it to be like this all the time. I mean, they would always have a thing and you know, they would inject, they develop a terrible disease and they would inject it in themselves to see what would happen. kind of those kinds of stories. But see, I'm terrible about that, because even with the current pandemic and stuff, I want to know where it came from, and I don't know anybody else that seems to want to know about that. So maybe I'm just crazy unique in that way.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this might just be like a writer's type of like thing, but it's also like whatever explanation me or if the creator, you know, the creators come together and come up with like a solid origin story explanation, it's still never going to suffice. You know what I mean? It's like there's never going to be like the scope of all these stories and, you know, what occurs in them, like knowing that if it A is a disease, you're like, oh, well, it's a disease that's causing all this. It's almost like, thinking like The Walking Dead. I never finished The Walking Dead. I stopped a little bit after, like, you know, Negan. I stopped during the All Out War when they're fighting Negan, like in the early hundreds issues. But to my knowledge, they never, Kirkman and Charlie Adler never gave the reasoning for the walker/zombies.
Well, they did end the story. They pulled a fast one on stores. They released the end, even though they had solicited several issues after it. Which, believe me, there were the store where I bought. I went in and got the book, and the lady who I buy from was furious, just livid. This is the end. She goes, I went, what? It's not the end. They've solicited another book. Because I was telling her when I got the number 200, I wanted to stop.
Yeah.
Nope. Mr. Kirkman had other plans for us. So that didn't work. But what you're saying is this is just in this universe, in the Purple Eyes universe, this is just the way it's always been.
Well, no, it's always been. It's been within the last decade or so.
Okay.
So there is this, like, I guess you could say, like, patient zero. There is obviously someone that this occurred to, and, you know, there it can trace back. But at this point, at least in this volume, because that's another thing. So this is Purple Eyes Volume 1. So because we've received so many pitches, I'm very eager to start doing Volume 2 early 2023. With some of the pitches that I had to made the very difficult decision to deny, at least this time around, and then also opening pitch submissions again. So, I mean, maybe something will type of, get that itch. You know, it could either be like the visual of, like the origin story of the first person that got purple eyes, or, now that, you know, we're talking about it, is I think it'd be like almost like an interesting story of like either a detective or like some type of like research analyst, like trying, as you watch them try to go back and forth. So like they're in the quote unquote present day and they're trying to like get all the tangential threads and like links and like interviewing people type of thing and like traveling around and trying to connect the dots themselves type of thing.
Yeah, see, I like that kind of stuff. I get so mad because they call it Detective Comics and he never does any detective work.
There's a lot of punching people in the face, but a lot of detective. Yeah.
No solving of puzzles and stuff. Because I always loved this. One thing I always loved about Batman was he was able to solve the most difficult puzzles. And they stopped. And I'm like, well, what happened to the detective work here? But I enjoyed what I read about that. If you look on the Kickstarter page, you've got several pages on there, and I was really intrigued by the taste of what we're going to get to see about that. About how apparently, like, some people get kind of irate when people get that in it, because one of these kids is calling people names. Stuff like that. And so I was wondering, do they react differently? Is that what's going on?
No, I think that was just kids being kids, actually. I think I just, okay. For that was my poor type. That might be poor writing of just like, oh yeah, kids are just, you know, calling each other names all the time. That's how you know they're kids.
Well, I'm just wondering, because I, you know, again, I love detective stories, so I'm sort of looking to see, is there any kind of hook that I should be looking for? kind of stuff. But this is just much more of a state of humanity kind of story.
Yeah, this one's more grounded. But yeah, I will say there is not like a straight detective story in this new anthology. I was really hoping for that. I'm a little bit behind, but yeah, I love, you know, what Brubaker and Phillips have been doing with Reckless. I haven't read the last one. Then they come out only a month or two ago. I'm the same way. Like, I want actual detective comics.
Well, don't worry. I got a stack of books as tall as me that I haven't gotten to yet. Now, let's talk a little bit. Now, again, I want to reiterate that this is going to all conclude on June the 15th, which is a Wednesday, at 12:02 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And the amount that you're after is pretty lofty, is 18,000. So I think that's going to be something we got to work hard to get. I have a feeling, just because. Have you done Kickstarters before?
Yeah. So this is actually my third Kickstarter. And the crazy part is, right before I launched, I was looking at the calendar, and I just chose June 15th. I thought that was a good enough length of time between launching. Like, I think it was close to 40 days of an active campaign. But June 15th last year was when I first launched my first Kickstarter. So between when this ended and when I began my, I guess, Kickstarter adventure, this would be, you know, Kickstarter number three. And I fulfilled, you know, both those Kickstarters pretty much right away within a month of the funds hitting my bank account. I started, you know, sending the book to the printer, and then started both Kickstarters. Spent two very long days packing up books, shipping them out. I got a pretty much mini post office. My office is a mini post office. I got the label maker and all the packing tape and stuff, and the Gemini mailers to make sure everything gets safe and sound, even across, you know. I got a lot of international backers.
But yeah. Well, as I look at it, when we're recording this a little early, you're over 100 backers already.
Yeah.
So that's 100, at least 100 packages you're going to have to send out. So yeah. Experience, so hopefully that'll make it a little easier if you know what you have to do.
Yeah, for sure. I've gotten a good rhythm down. But I did kind of want to bounce back on my, yes, so the campaign is for $18,000. And so one of the things that I was very, you know, very upfront about was that I wanted to pay a very fair page rate to all the creators. And one of the things I always pride myself in with my anthologies, this is my fourth one, is that I'm always encouraging newer creators, like younger creators, to just try to pitch. Or I try to, you know, the previous ones were, stories that I wrote, written about, that I wrote, and I found the collaborators. I was always trying to work and collaborate with newer creators that have the talent, but, you know, either they either don't have that much body of work, or, you know, they're predominantly either like web-based. So I'm the last Crackle Volume 3, two of the creators for two different stories. This was their first print. They've worked, you know, in various different, in the digital realm, but they've never seen their work in physical form and in print. And so I always try to pride myself with what I call like passing the ladder down. Like, I've gotten to, you know, I've worked my way up, and I've accomplished things narratively and I guess like business wise as far as comic books, but I always want to pass the ladder down to help other people that are in a similar position than I was like a year ago or 2 years ago. So there's a lot of first time creators. There's two off the top of my head. There might be more, I haven't asked, but there's two off the top of my head that are still that are young, and they're in some type of visual arts collegiate type courses, and that's what they're pursuing for their bachelors. And, I want them to get a good foot in the door and kind of like understand, like, no, your skill, your, your skills are very valuable and they're very rare. So you have to ask, when you start going in contracts, you start asking for what you think you deserve and not just be like, well, if I charge a, you know, if I say a low rate, then I'll definitely get this gig. So for this, I straight up said, like, it's going to be $100 per page for the creative teams. And I, you know, around this time, around the time I started having the open pitch submissions, I saw predatory rates that were half that. They were asking for, you know, $50, or I think one was 50 pounds, which I'm not sure what the equivalent to that is, but there was a few open submissions that was just like, I was like, this is predatory. Like if someone, it, you know, when the people that are accepting this are, they're putting more of their time and energy in than what their finances yield. I mean, that's, and not to mention that they're probably giving away the rights to their stories. Like I told all my creatives that you get the rights back to your stories. All I ask is to print it and be able to reprint in the collection. But if you want to, you can, you yourself can make a zine of it, or you can make, you know, you can put it in your own anthology collection or do whatever, but, you know, put it on your website. It's your work. It's your skill and your time. Like I'm not going to hold it and, you know, like a dragon on its gold. Like it's something that you created. You should cherish it.
So did you pay yourself? Are you paying yourself?
No.
Okay. That's usually how it goes. You'll pay other people. Like I often see Kickstarters where the artist and you know, and the printers and all these other people get paid. But it's rare when the writer / creator actually makes money off of a Kickstarter. It's usually going to everybody else. And so I'm interested that that's like, because if you look at the Kickstarter page, creators get 49% of the money.
Yeah, out of the budget.
Yeah, so that'll be good. Well, that's good, though. You want to get people who can make the, you know, who can suddenly, you know, have something print that they can show to people that when they're looking for work and stuff like that. So that's a really good thing you're doing, I think.
Yeah, and I give all. I mean, I've always done this, but I've given my collaborators at least 2 comp copies. I mean, regardless of where they are in the world, like I've collaborated with people all over the world. Like I've been fortunate enough to, you know, do 4 stories with Aditya Bidikar, who is an Eisner winning letterer, but he lives in India. So, you know, I send books all the way across the world to India, even though it's super expensive, but it's still, you know, I know him, he works on Detective Comics. He works on a lot of big DC and Marvel books and some indie stuff. I've been very lucky to have him work on my book or my short stories when I have. But I know that I'm one of the few people that actually send him the books in print because it's quote unquote far. But that's just, you know, it's, you know, if you create something, you should be able to enjoy, like, and indulge in it. You know, for me, it seems utterly silly and almost like offensive not to give your creative team their work. Or, you know, I've had friends that were part of anthologies, and the editor or whoever was curating it gave them no comp copies or 1 comp copy, and was able to offer them like almost like a discounted rate to buy the physical book for, you know, for basically at cost of print and stuff. And that just, you know, some of that just seems like not predatory, but just like, it doesn't seem like, it seems like you're not valuing the people you collaborate with. And like, it just, I don't know, it seems like you're too businessy instead of treating people like people. And I'm all against that.
Well, there was a guy I knew who would not pay the artist, and he would say, well, this is your chance to get, you know, your work out into the field so people could see your work. But I always like, well, you know, one of the ways to show that they're a real artist is to pay him.
Yeah.
So I don't hear much of that person anymore. I kind of figure he probably has to start paying people, or else what happens is people stop returning your calls if you're not going to pay them. I find out a lot of people do that. So anyway, I'm glad you're doing that, because supporting creators is the right thing. The bad news is, of course, is you being the ultimate creator, you don't get this, you don't get to make the money that the other people need to keep going. You get the benefit of having your book published and drawn and put together, and that's a great thing that you're doing there.
Yeah, there is that. I mean, there is that aspect. Like, even though I physically don't get any type of monetary type of gain, but I get this huge satisfaction gain of this thing that I've created and this team that I've kind of assembled and, like I said, curated, and this thing that, like, that's, you know, as storytellers, we take nothing and make it something. And in simplest terms, that's what a storyteller does. Like, nothing existed, and then between the creators, they put some ideas down on paper, and that ideas become images, and that those images, you know, is either, you know, they're physically made manifest in a comic book, or they're digitally made manifest in, you know, like a digital version of a comic. But yeah, it's like nothing, things, it didn't exist. Like, these things don't exist. And that's the crazy thing is, a year, you know, next time we talk, like a year or so from now, there's going to be something in my brain that wasn't there. And then some between that time frame, that idea permeated and grew like a tree. And, you know, and then I started seeking out other artists to help me with it, whether it be, you know, a unique anthology like this, or just more of a grounded, you know, story, like a one shot that it's just a smaller creative team. But it's, yeah, it's like that satisfaction of like knowing that you were the catalyst of to build this thing that didn't exist. It is hyper satisfactory.
Yep. Super cool. Now, one of the things I wanted to talk with you about before I let you go, I got a kick out of the different pledge levels. And the one I always like is you get to get drawn into a story.
Yeah.
I love those ones. I finally, a couple years back, actually got one that I could afford. And I got drawn into a book about a zombie Moby Dick. I was one of the sailors in there. And I got a huge kick out of being drawn into that. It was actually a level I could afford. You've got one for $100. Ever wanted to be drawn to a comic? Now you can. This tier is to be drawn into Stephen Charles Rosia. I'm sure I butchered that. Rosia story with his unique artistic style. Two spots are available. You have to provide reference photos, and you get a physical and digital copy of the book. That's cool. I you don't know how long I was hoping to do that. When it finally happened, I was like, oh, cool. So there are people out there who would love nothing better than to see their face inside a comic book. So I hope that, let's see, you had two, nobody's taken it yet, but hopefully they'll do that by the time this posts. So very cool stuff.
Yeah, that's the thing. Since we have so many stories, and I reached out, it was one of the topics of discussion, I think, for, you know, at least two of the Zoom meetings, of would anyone offer that? Do you think narratively you can fit it in? So it's not just a very, very small pic, you know, a small illustration of a person that, you know, it looks like the person, you know, it's not, they get, you know, they're getting their money's worth. And there were a good chunk of the artists that said that they can kind of, you know, they're building out the story, and they can visually see which panel they will put the people in. And a good chunk, like if you look at the Kickstarter page now, I'm not sure how much is going to be left, but a good chunk of those tiers are already gone. I think we had close to 10 slots total between all the, all the different artists that are offering up. And actually, right before we started hitting record, I was looking at the backer list, and another one was already claimed. Like, another one just got claimed, like, within the last, 20 minutes prior to us chatting.
Cool. So
it's like those are very popular, because they are, I would say, at a reasonably lower you know, a reasonably lower price. Or all of them have been at $100, but you know, the book itself is going for $25. So it's, you know, you're getting $75 to get yourself drawn, you know, drawn in this, you know, I would say unique, popular book. And you get, you know, and you get the book.
Definitely worth having. So it's a great idea. There's so many people out there who want desperately to be seen in the comic book, and I was one of those. And so I know people are going to enjoy that. I think they haven't taken it yet, but I bet anything those will disappear before long.
So. And that's another thing we've talked. There's Roberto is kind of playing around with, but we haven't announced it. But there might be, he might have one or two open more spots. And just chatting around, there's a couple. You know, there's another one that we haven't announced yet, but that's, you know, with the sex club one, that one we haven't put that tier up, but that's the one that has, you know, it's a club, like we can put people in those scenes. So we're just trying to play around with seeing what would be the best way, to do that. So even if you look at the campaign now, and you back it, and there is, you know, if you want to do the drawn in the story tier, and then they're all taken at this point, you know, back or come back in the next week or so, or toward the end, and you know, we might open up a few more. We have a couple left in the tank that we haven't kind of released. We're kind of trickling them out a little bit.
Very cool. Well, I think that's something that I know fans who love desperately. I mean, I was one of them. So I can say that there's people out there just dying to get drawn into a comic, so it's going to be great. I like the sub description. It says, the best creators in indie comics bring you tales of humor, heartache, and humility. I like that. Always avoid alliteration. It's one of my favorites. But so it's going to conclude on Wednesday, June 15 at 12:02 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, like I said, called Purple Eyes. If you go to Purple Eyes Volume 1, you'll find it out there, and I highly recommend you get there as soon as you get done listening to this interview and go out there and support this, because it's a really creative idea and something that probably going to spook me a little bit, but that's a good thing. I like being spooked every once in a while. So you said that there might be a volume 2 in the works. Is that what I heard you saying?
Yeah. I mean, we're in the earliest pre-production, but to kind of like go back as far as like the big thing about this book is all of us creators trying to figure out ways to like one up each other and find ways to link characters and settings, you know, and use elements that are within the world, like whatever proper names and buzzwords and lingo. But this isn't really spoiling anything, but one of the stories it revolves around someone that is naturally a, they die of natural causes because they're at that late stage in life, and doing all these Zoom meetings, we're like, well, part of that story is that person has a long distance and long history pen pal with someone, and that's an element of the story. And we're like, well, obviously we want one of the characters or have that other person that's a pen pal, but we're like, you know, most of the characters are within their 20s and 30s and 40s. There's no one that's like close to their 80s. And there's no natural smooth way for us to connect that thread, you know, and not make it feel forced. And so we were talking, Sky Berggren is the artist and writer for that, you know, the true cartoonist. And he's like, well, you know, why don't I just come back and write that story next time and like draw that story for the next volume? Because then since he's so grounded and knows that character, he, you know, his wheels are already turning to like that character's counterpoint, that someone that has been interacting with the character that he's currently developing, they've been developing. Now that I'm thinking about it, that's also interesting. Because these two elderly people, known each other before Purple Eyes was a thing within this world. Now, yeah. But yeah, it's just like things like that. Cause you know, and what I would, what, you know, what the end goal is would be, I think what I would be satisfied with, if we can do three of these things within, you know, within less than 5 years, three Purple Eyes anthologies. And on in the third Purple Eyes anthology, we get, you know, like a big fat book, you know, have all the book, have all three volumes in it. And that way you can see all the little threads. Like you
an
can
ultimate, see, an ultimate Purple Eyes.
Yeah, a big compendium. But then, because there are going to be, I know as soon as we start doing the second one, there's going to be fans of the first ones, you know, creative fans that are the first ones. Like, you know, I saw this and I thought of this, and like, you know, it's just the whole creative trying to one up each other. Like I said, of just like, yeah, it's, well, honestly, it's like almost like improv where everyone's just trying to, you know, say their line and have the word "and" at the end. But I just think of it almost like, you know, I listen a lot of jazz. Chicago has a fantastic jazz radio station, and the hosts are part of the jazz scene, and you know, but it just feels like that where you just, you're, everyone's just going full force and you're like a big brass, you know, jazz band. And then you stand up and you do your solo and then you just go back into it. And then, you know, then the person next to you goes, does their crazy solo. And then you just go back. That's what I just kind of like about it. It's like, everyone's just trying to build up, you know, everyone's building and making the rhythm strong and the beat go on, but then they stand up and they do their solo. And just, you know, the jaws drop from all the audience and they sit down and everything goes on. And then the next person stands up and does their crazy solo that they've spent their whole lives developing the skills for. It's just, yeah, it's just super exciting. It's so fun.
You've obviously got something going on, and I think there's a lot of good stories to be told. I got one last quick question for you. Why purple?
So that's not as glamorous of a story. Okay. It really isn't. It was just one of those things. I, you know, to like go to like all the aspects. So like I chose 73 minutes was not really chosen for any specific reason other than it is a very, very limiting, like you can't really do much. It's less than an hour and a half amount of time. But I kind of just like looked, I liked how the look of the 7 and 3 is, like on paper. And the purple was just kind of, I don't know. It seemed like peculiar. Like I never seen it before. It's one of those things, like you don't see it. And then once you're aware of it, you see it everywhere. Cause then like, what's his face? The new prequel ish of Game of Thrones is coming out soon, and so people are. So I never read the books, but I mean, I obviously watched the TV show. I guess Daenerys's eyes are purple in the books and stuff. So like, I saw like all these fan arts with like Daenerys with purple eyes. I was like, oh, and then there was just like, I forget. There was like an anime character. Of a series that I'm not familiar with that is purple eyes. And there was like a bunch of fan art, from a lot of my manga artist friends. I was like, oh, but it was all this afterward. It was like 3 weeks afterward of me writing down that and like already working on the scripts. And then like, you know, like a weekend, I had this feed full of like people with purple eyes. I'm like, yeah, there's something here. Like there's something in the air. And now I'm just kind of got on that wave early. But yeah, it's just like when just keep exploring it, I'm just like, well, you know, I chose it because it is not, you know, a human natural eye color. But like, I kept thinking like, well, you know, on the color spectrum, you know, violet, purple is on one end and red's on the other end. So maybe there is something, you know, something there that someone smarter than me can, you know, can go through scientifically, like, all right, well, violet has the least amount of, or the shortest wavelength, for all the color spectrum. So maybe there is something there that it's, you know, I don't know. I'm never past high school. physics.
I think you struck a nerve here. I think there's lots and lots to explore in this, and there's a lot of good things. Again, it's Purple Eyes Volume 1. It's going to conclude on Wednesday, June 15th at 12:02 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Again, don't wait until then. Get out there and support it right away so that Philip doesn't have to keep refreshing all the time. We get to the pledge, hit that 18,000 and go beyond. So there's all kinds of good things for that. So Philip, all I can say is keep it up. Obviously, we got lots of good things going on, and you're so excited about it. And other people obviously are really enjoying it as well. So keep up the wonderful stuff.
Yeah. Thanks, Wayne. Thanks. You know, and I hope to come back. We can chat about Volume 2. Because we're, you know, ideally we blow past, you know, this high 18 grand and go into the stretch goals, and the stretch goals obviously are paying the creators more money. You know, that's the big thing, is the more money we raise, the more it's going to be split evenly between, you know, between the creators.
Let's definitely talk again for sure.
All right. Thank you, Wayne.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics. We'll be right back.